Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this week's edition. This week we are sort of caught up in congressional politics and wrangling between the two parties as the massive infrastructure bill proposed by the Biden administration is being held in limbo and debated and compromised and curtailed. It's a spending package that includes many provisions for social infrastructure, that is, internet access, college tuition, healthcare, etc., all of which are very necessary and needed. But it also contains many provisions that have more directly to do with climate change. Together, they encompass much of what had earlier been proposed and called the Green New Deal, a number of provisions there that would wean society from fossil fuels and increase alternative energy production, that is to say, sustainable energy production, and also deal with transportation and urban planning and, of course, curtail emissions. Those provisions are essential to climate change folks. Anyone who's advocating planetary preservation realize the importance of those provisions. And yet, because of two Democrats in the Senate, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, we're being asked to compromise on the infrastructure bill overall, which means pitting social service programs against those climate change provisions. In my view, the climate change provisions are quintessential. They are absolutely bottom line. Those are the most important things that we could be doing right now. But for other folks who are facing a housing crisis or a health crisis or an education crisis, etc., it's understandable that their priorities may differ. Well, it's unfair that we should have to choose between the two, and maybe we won't have to for long. Progressive caucus leader Pramila Jayapal has explained that even if they compromise on the infrastructure bill, some of the provisions that will be put in place are expected to be very popular and could be codified into law. Therefore, other provisions could be also proposed individually and passed later on as the political climate changes to accommodate that kind of graciousness, that kind of optimism, that kind of responsibility. Today, we will hear several lectures and a small documentary about climate change, including a speech by Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of the now independent United Kingdom, and a couple of speeches by Greta Thunberg, the Swedish activist who has made a splash and is a frequent guest on Democracy Now. She's speaking at both a conference a year ago and more recently, so we'll hear how the change in the tone of her rhetoric reflects the relative intransience of national governments around the world, as everyone seems to be more or less dragging their feet. We'll start with Greta Thunberg.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for having me here, and thank you everyone for coming. My name is Greta Thunberg. I am a climate activist from Sweden, and for the last 9 months, I have been school striking for the climate every Friday in front of the Swedish Parliament. We need to change the way we treat the climate crisis. We need to change the way we speak about the climate crisis. And we need to call it what it is, an emergency. I am certain that most of us in here today are generally aware of the situation. But my number one experience during these last 9 months is that people in general have no clue. Many of us know something is wrong, that the planet is warming because of increased greenhouse gases, but we don't know the exact consequences of that. The vast majority know much less than we think, and this should be no surprise. We have never been shown the graphs which show how much the CO2 emissions need to be reduced for us to stay below the 1.5 degree limit. We have never been told the meaning of the aspect of equity in the Paris Agreement and why it's so important. We have never been taught about feedback loops or tipping points or what a runaway greenhouse effect is. Most of us don't know almost any of the basic facts. Because how could we? We have not been told. Or more importantly, we have never been told by the right people. We are Homo sapiens sapiens, of the family Hominidae, of the order Primates, of the class Mammalia, of the kingdom Animalia. We are a part of nature. We are social animals. We are naturally drawn to our leaders. During the last months, millions of children have been school striking for the climate, gaining lots of attention for the climate crisis. But we children are not leaders, nor are the scientists, unfortunately. But many of you here today are. Presidents, celebrities, politicians, CEOs, and journalists. People listen to you. They are influenced by you. And therefore, you have an enormous responsibility. And let's be honest, this is a responsibility that most of you have failed to take. You cannot rely on people reading between the lines or searching the information themselves. To read through the latest IPCC report, track the Keeling curve, or keep tabs on the world's rapidly disappearing carbon budget. You have to explain that to us repeatedly, no matter how uncomfortable or unprofitable that may be. And yes, a transformed world will include lots of new benefits, but you have to understand this is not primarily an opportunity to create new green jobs, new businesses, or green economic growth. This is above all an emergency, and not just any emergency. This is the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced. This is not something you can like on Facebook. When I first heard about the climate and ecological breakdown, I actually didn't believe that this could be happening. Because how could it be? How could we be facing an existential crisis that would threaten our very survival, and yet that wasn't our first priority? If there really was a crisis this big, then we would rarely talk about anything else. As soon as you turn on the TV, almost everything will be about that. Headlines, radio, newspapers, you would almost never hear or read about anything else. And the politicians would surely have done what was needed by now, wouldn't they? They would hold crisis meetings all the time, declare climate emergencies everywhere, and spend all their waking hours handling the situation and informing the people what was going on. But it never was like that. The climate crisis was just treated like any other issue, or even less than that. Every time you heard a politician speak about this, they never talked with urgency. According to them, there were always countless of new technologies and simple solutions that, when put in place, would solve everything. Politicians one second say, climate change is very important, it is the most important topic, and we are going to do everything we can to stop it. And the next second, they want to expand airports, build new coal power plants and motorways, and then they fly off in a private jet to attend a meeting on the other side of the world. That is not how you act in a crisis. And humans are social animals. We can't get away from that fact. And as long as you, the leaders, act like everything is fine and you have things under control, then us people, we won't understand that we are in an emergency. You can't only keep talking about specific isolated solutions to specific isolated problems. We need to see the full picture. If you say that we can solve this crisis, just by maybe increasing or lowering some taxes, phasing out coal in 10 or 15 years, putting up solar panels on new building, or manufacturing new, more electrical cars. If you say that, then people will think we can solve this crisis without anyone making a real effort. And that is very dangerous, because specific isolated solutions are no longer enough. And you know this. We now need to change practically everything. We now need a whole new way of thinking. I know you are desperate for hope and solutions, but the biggest source of hope and the easiest solution is right in front of you and has been all along. And it is us people and the fact that we don't know. We humans are not stupid. We are not ruining the biosphere and future living conditions for all species because we are evil. We are simply not aware. But once we understand, once we realize the situation, then we act, we change. Humans are very adaptable. So instead of only being obsessed with finding solutions to a problem that most of us do not even know exists, you must also focus on informing us about the actual problem. We must acknowledge that we do not have all the solution now. We must admit that we do not have the situation under control. And we must admit that we are losing this battle. We must stop playing with words and numbers because we no longer have time for that. And in the words of author Alex Steffen, winning slowly is the same thing as losing when it comes to the climate crisis. The longer we wait, the harder it will be to turn this around. So let's not wait any longer. Let's start acting. For too long, the people in power have gotten away with basically not doing anything to stop the climate and ecological breakdown. They have gotten away with stealing our future and selling it for profit. But we young people are waking up, and we promise we will not let you get away with it anymore. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you to all of you, you faithful few who have waited to the end of this very, very important session, and very good to see my audience over there. Listen, folks, an inspection of the fossil record over the last 178 million years, which is since mammals first appeared, reveals that the average mammalian species, that's we're all mammals, exists for about 1 million years before it evolves into something else, or else vanishes into extinction. And of our allotted lifespan of 1 million years, humanity, Homo sapiens, has been around for about 200,000 years. In other words, we're still collectively a youngster. If you imagine that 1 million years as the lifespan of an individual human being, about 80 years, then we're now sweet 16. We've come to that fateful age when we know roughly how to drive, and we know how to unlock the drinks cabinet and to engage in all sorts of activity that is not only potentially embarrassing but also terminal for ourselves and others. In the words of the Oxford philosopher Toby Ord, we're just old enough to get ourselves into serious trouble. And I'm afraid we believe, we still cling with parts of our minds to the infantile belief that the world was made for our gratification and pleasure, and we combine this narcissism with an assumption of our own immortality. We believe that someone else will clear up the mess, because that is what someone else has always done. And we trash our habitats again and again with the inductive reasoning that we've got it, we've got away with it so far, and therefore we'll get away with it again. My friends, the adolescence of humanity is coming to an end and must come to an end. We're approaching that critical turning point in less than 2 months, in just over 40 days, when we must show that we are capable of learning and maturing and finally taking responsibility for the destruction we are inflicting, not just upon our planet, but upon ourselves. It's time for humanity to grow up. It's time for us to listen to the warnings of the scientists. And if you look at COVID, if you want to see an example of the gloomy scientists being proved right, it's time for us to grow up and understand who we are and what we are doing. The world, this precious blue sphere with its eggshell crust and wisp of an atmosphere, is not some indestructible toy, some bouncy plastic romper room against which we can hurl ourselves to our heart's content. Daily, weekly, we are doing such irreversible damage that long before a million years are up, we will have made this beautiful planet effectively uninhabitable, not just for us, but for many other species. And that is why the Glasgow COP26 summit is the turning point for humanity. We must limit the rise in temperatures, whose appalling effects were visible even this summer, to 1.5 degrees. We must come together in a collective coming of age. We must show that we have the maturity and wisdom to act. And we can. Even in this past 16 years, as it were, this feckless youth that we've just passed, we've shown our skill. We've harnessed clean energy from wind and wave and sun. We've released energy from within the atom itself and from hydrogen. We found ways to store that energy in increasingly capacious batteries and even in molten salt. We have the tools for a green industrial revolution. We've got the kit, but time is desperately short. 2 days ago, here in New York, we had a session in which we heard from the leaders of the nations most threatened by climate change, the Marshall Islands, the Maldives, Mr. President, Bangladesh, and many others. And they spoke of the hurricanes and the flooding and the fires caused by the extreme meteorological conditions the world is already seeing. And the tragedy is that because of our past inaction, there are further rises in temperatures that are already baked in. And my friends, baked is the word. If we keep on the current track, then the temperatures will go up by 2.7 degrees or more by the end of the century. And never mind what that will do to the ice flows, dissolving like ice in your martini here in New York. We will see desertification, drought, crop failure, and mass movements of humanity on a scale not seen before. Not because of some unforeseen natural event or disaster, but because of us, because of what we are doing now. And our grandchildren will know that we are the culprits, and they will know that we knew, that we were warned, and they will know that it was this generation that came center stage to speak and act on behalf of them, on behalf of posterity, and that we missed our cue. And they will ask themselves what kind of people we were to be so selfish and so short-sighted. In just 40 days' time, we need the world to come to Glasgow to make the commitments necessary. And we're not talking, I'm afraid, about stopping the rise in temperatures. We can't do that. It's too late to stop the rise in temperatures. But to restrain that growth, as I say, to 1.5 degrees. And that means we need to pledge collectively to achieve carbon neutrality, net zero, by the middle of the century. And that will be an amazing moment if we can do it, because it will mean that for the first time in centuries, humanity is no longer adding to the budget of carbon in the atmosphere, no longer thickening that invisible quilt that is warming the planet. And it's fantastic that we now have countries here at the UN representing 70% of the world's GDP who are committed to this net zero objective. 70% of the world GDP, and I'm proud to say when my friend and colleague Alok Sharma, the president-designate of COP26, began his mission, his peregrinations around the world, that number was only 30% of world GDP. So we're getting there, is the point I'm making. And we can go further. And if we are going to stave off these hikes, these rises in temperature, we must go further. And we must go faster. We need all countries, every single one of you, to step up and commit to very substantial reductions by 2030. And I'm absolutely convinced, I passionately believe, that we can do it by making commitments in four areas. And I want you to remember them: coal, cars, cash, and trees. Coal, cars, cash, and trees. It's very simple. I'm not one of those environmentalists, by the way, who takes a moral pleasure in excoriating humanity for its excess. I don't see the green movement as a pretext for a wholesale assault on capitalism. Far from it. The whole experience of the COVID pandemic is that the way to fix the problem is through science and innovation, the breakthroughs and the investments that are made possible by capitalism and free markets. And it's through our Promethean faith in new green technology that we are cutting emissions in the UK. When I was a kid, we produced almost 80% of our electricity from coal. I know that some of you here tonight rely very heavily on coal. But in the UK, that percentage is now down to 2% or less, and coal will be gone altogether from our energy production by 2024. We've put in great forests of beautiful wind turbines on the drowned prairies of Doggerland between Britain and Holland in the North Sea. In fact, we produce so much offshore wind that I'm thinking of changing my name in honour of the god of the North Wind to Boreas Johnson. There you go. There's a shove in that classical allusion this time of night to see if you're paying attention, folks. And I know that we're ambitious in asking the developing world to end the use of coal power by 2040, and for the developed world to do so by 2030. But the experience of the UK shows that it can be done, and profitably too. And I want to thank very much President Xi of China for what he has just done to end China's international financing of coal. And I hope China will now go further and phase out the domestic use of coal as well. Wouldn't that be a great thing? Because the experience of the UK shows that it can be done. And when I was elected Mayor of London, only a mere 13 years ago, I was desperate to encourage more electric vehicles. And we went around the city putting in charging points. And I'm afraid to say that in those days, those charging points were pretty lonely objects and not much patronized. But today, it's totally different. And the market for electric vehicles is growing at an extraordinary pace, maybe two-thirds every year. And Nissan is sufficiently confident now to invest £1 billion in a new EV factory plus a gigafactory for batteries. And that is because the government, we have set the hard deadline for the sale of new hydrocarbon internal combustion engine vehicles by 2030, the most aggressive deadline in the whole of Europe. And again, we call on the world to come together to drive this market in a low-carbon way, drive this market so that by 2040 there are only zero-emission vehicles on sale anywhere in the world. And my point is that you can make these cuts in pollution, these massive cuts in pollution and emissions, while driving jobs and growth. We've cut our greenhouse gas emissions by 44% in the last 30 years, while expanding our GDP by 78%. And we will now go further by implementing one of the biggest nationally determined contributions currently being offered. The nationally determined contribution is the NDC, is the pledge that in the run-up to COP, we're asking every country to make in cutting carbon. We're going to go down by 68% by 2030, 68% cut in carbon by 2030 compared to where we were in 1990. We're making a big bet on hydrogen. We're going to be expanding our nuclear capacity, and you can see the logic of going for more renewables when you look at the spike in hydrocarbon prices, particularly gas. We're helping people to reduce their own household CO2 by retrofitting their homes and going for new sources of heating. We're working towards Jet Zero, the first large guilt-free, carbon-free passenger plane. And we also recognize that this is not just about using technical fixes, technology to cut CO2. We also need to work together around the world to restore the balance between humanity and nature, a balance that's obviously been proved so hopelessly out of whack by the emergence of a zoonotic pandemic, for instance. We need to halt and reverse the loss of trees and biodiversity by 2030. Halt and reverse the loss of trees by 2030. That's what we should do. Pledge to do that at the COP in just 40 days' time. And that's why we in the UK are committed to beautifying the landscape, strengthening our protection against flooding by planting millions more trees, beautiful trees that stop soil erosion, provide habitats for insects and birds and mammals, and which, of course, help to fix carbon in the atmosphere. We must also work towards the crucial UN Summit on Biodiversity in Kunming in China. And by the way, on the subject of planting trees, we're going to do millions in the UK, but I was absolutely blown away. I invite everybody to follow the example of Imran Khan of Pakistan, who has pledged to plant 10 billion trees in Pakistan alone, and he's going some. And I think it's very important that we in the developed world recognize our obligation to help less developed countries down this path in all these technologies. And we've got to be honest. We in the United Kingdom, we in Britain, started this industrial hydrocarbon-based revolution. We were the first to send great puffs of acrid smoke into the heavens on a scale big enough to derange the natural order. And though we were, in fact, of course, doing something rather wonderful in one sense, we were setting in train a new era of technology that was itself to lead to a massive global reduction in poverty, emancipating billions of people around the world. The Industrial Revolution was a good thing, fundamentally. But we were also unwittingly beginning to quilt the great tea cozy of carbon dioxide around the world. And so we understand that when the developing world looks to us to help, we must take our responsibilities. And that's why 2 years ago, when I last came here, Mr. President, to UNGA, I committed that the UK would provide £11.6 billion to help the rest of the world to tackle climate change. And I want you to know that in spite of all the pressures on our finances in the UK caused by COVID, we have kept that promise to the letter. And so I'm very pleased and encouraged by some of the pledges we've heard here at UNGA, including from Denmark, and now a very substantial commitment from the United States that brings us within touching distance of that $100 billion pledge that we need every year. But we must go further, and we've got to be clear that government alone and government cash alone is not going to be enough. We must work together so that the international financial institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, are working with governments around the world to leverage in the private sector, because it is the trillions of dollars of private sector cash that will enable developing nations and the whole world, all of us, to make the changes necessary. And to give an example, it was the UK government that set the strike price under the contract for difference system, the strike price for the private sector to come in and transform our country into the Saudi Arabia of wind. And if you see what I mean, we don't resemble Saudi Arabia in many ways, but we, in terms of offshore wind, we have a fantastic. We produce more offshore wind than any other country in the world. And only yesterday, the UK's first sovereign green bond raised £10 billion on the markets from hard-headed investors who want to make money. And my point is that these investments will not only help the countries of the world to tackle climate change, they will produce millions, I mean literally in the decades to come, millions and millions of high-wage, high-skill jobs. And today's workforce and the next generation of green-collar workers will have the extra satisfaction of knowing that they're not only doing something useful and well-remunerated, providing green energy, but also helping to save the planet at the same time. Every day, green startups are producing new ideas, from feeding seaweed to cows to restrain their traditional signs of digestive approval, to using artificial intelligence and robotics to enhance food production, capture CO2, put it into brownies, and so on. And it's these technological breakthroughs that will cut the cost for consumers, so that we have nothing to fear and everything to gain from this green industrial revolution. And when Kermit the Frog sang, "It's not easy being green." You remember that one? I want you to know that he was wrong. He was wrong. It is easy. It's not only easy, it's lucrative, and it's right to be green. He was also unnecessarily rude to Miss Piggy, I thought, Kermit the Frog. But it is easy to be green. We have the technology, as we used to say when I was a kid. We can do it. We have. So in 40 days' time, we have the choice before us. The poet Sophocles is often quoted by me anyway, as saying that there are many terrifying things in the world, but none is more terrifying than mankind. And it's certainly true that Sophocles was right in that sense, in that our species is uniquely capable of our own destruction and the destruction of everything around us. But if you look at the Greek, what Sophocles actually said was that man, polita deina kuden anthropou deinotron pele, is what he said. It's deinos, man is deinos, and terrifying isn't quite right as a translation for deinos. What Sophocles really means is that mankind is humanity is awesome. We're both terrifying but also awesome, and I think he was right there. We have an awesome power to change things, and to change things for the better, and an awesome power to save ourselves. And in the next 40 days, we have to choose, the world has to choose, what kind of awesome we're going to be. And to get back to my metaphor of adolescence, I hope that COP26 will be a 16th birthday party for humanity, in which is not a not miserable, but a party in which we choose to grow up, to recognize the scale of the challenge that we faced, and to do what posterity demands that we must. And so I invite this great UN Assembly in November to come and take part by your actions in what I hope will be a global coming of age, and to blow out the candles, if you like, blow out the candles of a world on fire. That's what I think we should do. So thank you all very much. Thank you for the pledges that you're making. I hope that you will increase them and do what is necessary. And Mr. President, see you in Glasgow. Thank you.
On behalf of the General Assembly, I wish to thank the Prime Minister, First Lord of the Treasury, and Minister for the Civil Service of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland for the statement just made, and I request protocol to escort His Excellency. Well, we have heard the last speaker in the general debate for this meeting. We will continue the general debate tomorrow at 9 a.m. in this hall. The meeting is adjourned.
July 2021. After severe rainfall, the Ahr Valley in western Germany was hit by an enormous flood. Water gushed through the villages, killing over 100 people and damaging thousands of houses. Extreme weather events are occurring more frequently all over the world, not just in Germany. Rising sea levels and heavy rainfall cause devastating floods.
From now on, every day, somewhere in the world, we will have an extreme weather event, unprecedented weather event like we never had before.
There are already over 20 million climate refugees worldwide today. If we don't take climate change seriously, there could soon be many more.
By how much will the average global temperature rise? And how much more extreme will the extremes be? It's a question of life or death.
The village of Altenburg in the Ahr Valley, a few weeks after the devastating flood. The clear-up operation is in full swing. 90% of the houses were damaged. Since the river also transported toxic oils, almost all the buildings have to be stripped down to the masonry. Sascha Meyer was also affected by the disaster. The night of the flood is something he will never forget.
At that moment, all I could do was shout out to my wife, "We are flooding." Then she came out of the room carrying Jack. I grabbed John, and then we made our way straight to the attic.
The family spent the whole night there. Sascha removed the roof tiles from one part of the roof.
We needed to find an emergency exit because the water kept on rising. I looked out of the small window, and the water had risen to the second row of roof tiles. We kept in contact with our neighbors. They were also in the top part of their house. You can see how far up the water came. They were also worrying about how high the water would rise. It was a terrifying moment, because we just didn't know when it would stop.
That night, the Meyers lost everything they had. Just 15 months previously, they had bought their house and moved in.
From the ground floor, we managed to salvage the family records and my children's savings books. We had to throw everything else away because it was covered in mud or oil or just filth. At that moment, it was all about surviving, and we did survive.
For many years, scientists have been warning that extreme weather conditions would increase with climate change. Kira Winker has no doubts that the situation is deadly serious.
At the moment, we're roughly 1 degree above the pre-industrial age temperature, which means we are already in the midst of climate change. We have to realize that the effects are increasingly serious. It's not a linear change. It won't just get a little bit worse. It can get considerably worse with every degree of global warming, which means a very, very tough challenge for us to adapt to climate change.
The Geographic Institute of the University of Bonn. Lothar Schrott heads the master's program on the prevention and management of catastrophes here. The risk researcher sees huge communication deficits shortly before the flood in the Ahr Valley.
There was a storm warning, a warning of a flood, but the residents didn't know what the consequences might be. They didn't know, what should I do now? I heard reports of some people taking amateur precautions and driving their car right to the top of the Ahr Valley. In the end, it was the only car left. The others were all swept away.
The disaster in the Ahr Valley showed how ineffective Germany's early warning system is. But what should be done now?
I think we need a mix of different methods. People talk a lot about these warning apps. I have two myself on my cell phone. But if the mobile network is down, then the apps are of no use. That has become clear.
A simple and effective measure would be flood sirens, for example. They could warn all local residents of an impending disaster.
But the siren has to go off in plenty of time, not when we can already see the water. If they know 3 or 4 hours ahead, then they should sound the siren and train people how to react in a situation like that. It's no good everyone getting in their car and the roads all getting blocked up with traffic jams and people drowning that way. We had received warnings that the flood level would reach 5.5 meters. We heard about it in the afternoon in our fire station, but we could hardly believe it, because we thought, where should all that water come from? 5.5 meters. That would have been about 2 meters higher than in 2016. We simply couldn't believe it.
In the end, the river was up to 9 meters high, flooding buildings right up to the roof. The Netherlands are much further ahead of Germany when it comes to flood protection. For centuries, they've been wresting land back from the sea. In the past, windmills helped to lower the water level. Nowadays, powerful pumping stations work around the clock to keep the land dry. Around a quarter of the Netherlands are below sea level. Engineers are building even higher dikes and flood barriers, like in Nijmegen. The whole town is surrounded by a protective wall. In times of flooding, the openings can be closed off by gates or with special steel profiles.
This is how a steel profile looks. We use them to make a so-called coupure. They are stacked on top of each other, and the rubber profile ensures that the flood wall is sealed. And this is where the coupure is built up. First, we remove this cover. Behind it, there is the frame for a flood wall, so we have double protection. First, we put in a base, and then we lay one profile on top of another until they reach this height.
Along with the safety barriers surrounding individual towns, the Dutch have built gigantic flood barriers along the North Sea coast. At the Maasland flood barrier, two metal gates, each 210 metres long, protect the land behind them. The Oosterschelde flood barrier stretches for 9 kilometres along the coast. Although the Dutch have invested huge sums in flood management, they know that it will not be enough. Frank Spargaren was a member of the team which developed the Oosterschelde flood barrier.
Most people agree that sea levels could rise by 1 meter by the end of this century. That would have enormous consequences for the flood barrier, but also for the whole area behind it. If the water rises that much, I don't think the flood barrier will be able to hold back the water in 2100. It'll have to be torn down.
Since higher dikes alone do not offer enough protection, the Dutch are now trying a new strategy, living with the water instead of against it. The dikes are being lowered and new drainage channels are being built. In times of flooding, parts of the land will be flooded for a short period. The people who live in these areas are being relocated to artificially created hills, financed by taxes. Dutch technology could also help in Bangladesh. The south of the country is threatened by rising sea levels and floods as a result of climate change. In the north, the rivers carry huge masses of water in the monsoon season. Climate change is making the monsoon stronger and more unpredictable, with increasingly more land being flooded as a consequence. The renowned climate researcher Salimul Haq sees an obligation for rich countries.
The vast majority of that pollution has come from the rich countries. Poor countries do some, but not as much as the rich countries. And therefore, the rich countries have a very strong responsibility to help the poor countries deal with that. In Germany, after you had the flash floods, your Chancellor Angela Merkel went and visited, and she immediately allocated and found 300 million euros to compensate German citizens from the impacts of loss and damage from climate change. Absolutely correct thing to do, but they should also think about victims in Bangladesh and in Africa who are suffering from their pollution, and they owe them a measure of support in financial terms as well.
So far, little outside help has come to Bangladesh, and too little to offer effective protection. Measures such as sandbags, dikes, and cyclone-proof housing can no longer keep the water at bay. As a result, more and more people are fleeing the countryside and moving to the cities. They try to build up a new existence there, crammed into the narrow alleyways of the slums. People like Jahurul, who came to the capital Dhaka with his parents in 2020, when a third of Bangladesh was underwater. He left his wife and children behind.
Before the flood, we had a normal life. But we lost everything in the flood. We managed to survive by fleeing to the village school. After a while, we decided to borrow some money and come to Dhaka.
Jahurul's parents borrowed the equivalent of around 10 euros to pay for their move to Dhaka. Now, the three of them share a room which is smaller than 15 square meters.
After we arrived, we searched for work for weeks. Finally, my son got a job in a clothing company, and I was employed in a household. We earn very little, and my husband has a heart problem. His medication is very expensive.
Due to his health problems, the father is unable to work. He spends his days in a cafe or in bed. His son works in the textile industry, earning around 70 euros per month. But the medication for his father costs 40 euros alone.
We have to manage to somehow get back to our village. My parents still live there. We came to Dhaka because we are poor. But we have to go back.
Many people who come from rural areas to Dhaka every year hope to return, but few of them actually manage it. The city now has over 20 million inhabitants. Illegal settlements are sprouting up wherever there is free space. The infrastructure is overstretched.
Once upon a time, we had our hundreds of canals in Dhaka city. And so the water easily could discharge and surrounding the Dhaka city, we had our wetlands. Where is the wetland? Most of the wetlands are very much occupied by this and grabbed by these particular builders. Unfortunately, so this is a very unplanned situation.
Urgent solutions are needed to stop Dhaka from collapsing.
One of the things that we are working on, and my center is working on, is developing what we call climate-resilient, migrant-friendly towns. We have identified about 20 smaller towns, and we are looking at ways in which we can attract the climate migrants to go to those towns and live there instead of come to Dhaka City.
Solutions also have to be found for the rural population. Unlike the Netherlands, there is no money available for expensive projects. In the Ministry of Agriculture in Dhaka, agronomist Masharul Aziz is developing better early warning systems to alert the inhabitants of flood areas.
We have the database of 30,000 lead farmers all over the Bangladesh. So in case of flooding, we generate SMS, short SMS, tailored SMS, what to do for the farmers. We generally circulate or disseminate this kind of SMS and IVR to the farmers. And these lead farmers, they convey the message to their group members. So in this way, we are advancing to combat with the flood situation.
Another solution could come from the south of Bangladesh. In this huge river delta, large swathes of land have now been underwater for over 8 months. Some farmers, like Obeda Mola, have revived an old technique for growing vegetables on floating plant beds.
I watched my father doing it. He had a few plants on the water. But it wasn't systematic back then. We have developed it further. We don't have any other options if we don't want to starve.
To make the floating beds, the farmer and his worker tie together rice straw, aquatic plants and cow dung. Then they grow their vegetables on the floating compost heaps.
The vegetables grown on water taste better and have more vitamins. We don't need artificial dung or pesticide. That's why the vegetables are much better than those grown on land. Much better.
The farmer is proved right by his success. His vegetables grow at record speed. Moller earns three times as much as other farmers in the region. Up to now, these floating gardens only existed in a small area in the south of the country. If one third of Bangladesh is going to be permanently flooded in the future, as researchers predict, they could be a model for other regions. Not all plants can be grown on the floating beds, however, such as the staple food, rice. The huge rice fields are often flooded for days at a time, which endangers the crop. Researchers are developing new types of rice.
These varieties, they can tolerate up to 15 days of submergence. So this kind of, we are advocating our farmers to plant this kind of rice varieties in flood-prone areas. And also we make some buffer seed beds in different high places where when the water recedes, we generally distribute the seedlings to the farmers.
None of these measures can prevent large parts of Bangladesh being uninhabitable in the future, and the country is already five times more densely populated today than Germany.
Bangladesh cannot adapt to everything. So the sea level rise, for example, in the low-lying coastal area, is becoming saline. We are adapting to salinity with saline-tolerant varieties of crops. We are switching from rice to growing shrimp and crab. But there's a limit to how much we can adapt. Sooner or later, the people living there will not be able to continue their livelihoods. They'll have to leave.
Mozambique, 2019. Cyclone Idai swept across the Southeast African country, flooding huge parts of the coastal regions. International aid organizations had to save people from drowning. The port city of Beira was particularly badly affected. Huge parts of the city were flooded and a slum by the water was almost completely destroyed. Thousands of people had to flee. The situation 2 years on. Julia Mahangwiza used to live in the slum.
All this area was my house. The walls were here. Here I had rooms to rent. And here my three rooms. Everything collapsed. A woman lost her life there when a brick fell on her head.
Julia no longer lives here. But her former neighbours have stayed.
When the cyclone came, we didn't know what to do. Some people moved away, some are still here. We all need to be moved from here.
We have no other place to live. That's why we stayed here.
We are asking for help. We are in a bad situation.
Really bad. We have to find something to eat and try to survive.
The local authorities were planning to relocate all of the slum dwellers after the cyclone, but many do not want to leave. They can find casual jobs both in the slum and in the nearby town, for example as fishermen or street vendors. They accept the risk of having to rebuild their homes after every flood. Around 1 hour away from Beira, here the government has initiated a project to resettle people from flood-prone areas. Small houses have been built for the inhabitants, but only the outer shells. The residents themselves who recently moved here are responsible for further building work. Julia Mahangwiza also received an offer to move here with her three daughters.
When we came, this area used to be only bush. So we started working. But we need electricity. And they have also stopped food aid supplies. We are old people, and we can't do much here.
None of the houses are finished so far. There's no material for the roof. Instead, people have been living in huts they built themselves next to the houses. Some of the new settlers try to scrape together a living from selling things. Most of them have to commute to the town to work, which is a great financial burden. The resettlement of the victims of climate change is too great a challenge for a poor country such as Mozambique. All they can do is offer better protection to people living on the coast. In Beira, for example, wave breakers are meant to prevent the erosion on the coast in storm tides.
And climate change is mainly caused by economically and financially robust countries. They urgently have to help the countries with less resources to face climate change.
Germany currently contributes 4 billion euros per year to a green climate fund to support poor countries. But the German government has provided eight times as much money to rebuild the Ahr Valley in Germany, 30 billion euros. Risk researcher Lothar Schrott takes a closer look at the situation in the Ahr Valley.
Some people are already occupied with reconstruction strategies, but we are still completely involved in the follow-up of the catastrophe, and a lot of money is flowing into that. If we had invested this money in the prevention of a catastrophe, it would have been cheaper and much more human.
It's all the more important to draw the right conclusions to keep the Ahr Valley habitable.
When we are in the Ahr Valley, we see vineyards, which have a high touristic value, and also for the individual winemakers, of course. But maybe mistakes were made here.
For instance, instead of having small stepped vineyards, there are now large areas which are very steep. The vines are often planted vertically. Areas like this can barely absorb rainwater. They channel it directly into the valley. Forests are not prepared for climate change either.
We can see from the land use that we have a high number of spruce trees, not deciduous trees. But deciduous trees can retain much more water, which slows down the flow.
However, transitioning to a fully grown mixed forest takes over 100 years, and such measures only help to prevent smaller floods. In the case of extreme flooding, structural solutions are required.
It could be artificially laid retention basins, built where hollows are actually dug out, and maybe equipped with barriers so that the water can't reach lower-lying areas. They could also be natural retention areas, like in the floodplains.
This could avoid high water levels accumulating in tributaries which then flood the valley. But even such elaborate and expensive measures will not offer enough security in the long run.
I think it would be a responsible approach now, when it comes to rebuilding, that people are advised against reconstruction in especially flood-prone areas. It would be irresponsible towards the people who settled there.
It was previously claimed that disasters like the one in the Ahr Valley are a once-in-a-century occurrence. But it's now become clear that such events could now occur more frequently.
We really have an existential challenge. We saw it in the Eifel region, we see it now with forest fires worldwide. We see it in Bangladesh and Mozambique. More extreme climate consequences are visible everywhere. It means that we have to do much more, both in emissions reduction, mitigation, as well as in adapting to climate change. Everybody has to take responsibility now. In countries like Bangladesh and Mozambique, it's already too late.
Greta Thunberg, Boris Johnson, and a short documentary on climate change. All of this information is going into the climate summit, which will be happening shortly in the next month or so. That should be very interesting. I look for lots of coverage of that on Democracy Now!, which will probably be there live, I would imagine. Or if not, other independent media sources will be there reporting live, and we'll certainly have that information here on this show. which has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care.